It is now my distinct honor to introduce our keynote speaker this afternoon, who we thought, given the theme of this year's conference, would really enhance the event, and indeed, I'm sure that it will. Ambassador Ron Kirk, the former U.S. Trade Representative, is also a former mayor of Dallas, the fourth largest metropolitan area in the country. He was mayor from 1995 to 2002. And as mayor, he did whatever he possibly could, and with other mayors, to promote trade and to recognize that international trade would benefit all of us. Mr. Kirk then was nominated and served as U.S. Trade Representative from 2009 to 2013, and he was a key player in President Obama's economic team, recognizing the importance of increasing trade as a way of dealing with an intractable economic situation. He successfully negotiated trade pacts with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, and was instrumental in enforcing important trade rules for China. It is my honor to welcome Ambassador Ron Kirk.
Good afternoon. How are y'all? I just want to make sure. I know how it can be on Thursday afternoon or after a long conference. I am thrilled to be with you. Bob, thank you so much to you and Ed for the invitation to come and join you for this important conference. If you'll forgive me for just one moment being a former mayor, but welcome to North Texas. Welcome to Dallas. I would like to believe in your industry, you are very familiar with our part of the world, but we are thrilled to have you here, and I hope you take advantage of all of our hospitality, all of our amenities, enjoy our restaurants, our shopping, our golf, and all of the wonderful things that make North Texas the great place that it is to be. Secondly, I want to say thank you to your association and many of your affiliated partners for your very strong and vocal support of a smart trade policy for our country over the years. And I've had the opportunity to work with so many of you, particularly, as Bob mentioned, during my tenure as U.S. Trade Representative, when I inherited the three stalled trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and Korea, and working with you and so many others in agriculture and manufacturing and the service industry, we were able to get what I thought and what the president thought was a very good deal for America's farmers and ranchers and families and exporters, and did something unprecedented in Congress and in administrations. And we passed all three trade agreements in one night. And in addition to that, we also renewed the trade adjustment assistance package for our workers. The reason we were able to do that is that we understood when we came into the administration in 2009, that part of America climbing out of the economic tsunami that we inherited when we came into office had to be strengthening and extending our commercial ties around the world. But we also understood we were very much swimming upstream, because in poll after poll after poll at that time, show that almost 70% of Americans were opposed to trade. So we knew we needed a different kind of trade agreement, and we needed a different argument to make to the American public about why we should be engaged with the world. And one of the reasons I was excited about the opportunity to speak to you is normally I'm talking to people who are screaming at me about trade, and they're angry, and they tend to think that I ignored Ross Perot, and we live in this Disney world down here of Texas. But it's good to be with a group that, by not only the theme of your conference, but by the very nature of your business, you understand the importance of going global, that it is a practical and a smart way to help sustain and grow our economy here at home, And that the way that we do that is by having a progressive and market opening trade agenda that creates more markets for you and creates more markets for other Americans. So when we came into office, we sought out to do several things, and that was one, to rebalance our approach to trade. And we focused on four major goals. One, we wanted agreements that would give us the market access that you deserve, but particularly give us market access on terms that were at least fair and favorable to American exporters. Secondly, we knew that we had to have trade agreements that reflected values that were important to the American public. Because so much of the opposition to trade is people believe that trade agreements with economies that aren't as vast, that aren't as advanced as ours, are nothing more than a vehicle by which to shift manufacturing, i.e. jobs, to somewhere else. And so we made a commitment that we wouldn't put in place any trade agreement that didn't have at least a basic understanding and a basic commitment to how workers ought to be treated, not exactly like we have in the United States, but as strong of an agreement on labor laws and the protection of workers as we could get, and the same for the environment. And then finally, and you heard Bob mention it, the number one complaint that I heard from not only opponents of trade, but even friends like you, was there was a sense that America had just not enforced our rights under the existing agreements that we had. And that, frankly, our trading partners were cleaning our clock. And people felt like no administration, Democrat or Republican, was willing to stand up and enforce America's trade rights for our exporters. And we agreed that we would do that, and we did. And we embarked on one of the most thoughtful and, I think, successful enforcement programs of any administration before. And because of those four things, the commitment to opening new markets, to incorporating our values, making sure that you'd have a level playing field, and then demonstrating, not just saying, that we would enforce our rights, that allowed us to have a platform in which we were able to put in place those trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and Korea. Now, I don't just say that to brag on the work that we did in the administration. The results of that, I think, have been profound. One of the things President Obama challenged us to do, those of us who were involved in the international sector, was to double U.S. exports over 5 years. A lot of people thought that was gimmicky. But because of the work that we've done, since 2009, U.S. exports have grown 2.5 times faster than our economy. We've added over $760 billion to our economy since 2014 because of export-related activity. And exports now make up over 13% of our GDP for the first time in history. And that's also the highest level of our GDP it's ever been. In 2014, we exported $2.3 trillion in U.S.-made goods and services. That's the most ever in American history. And most importantly and most relevant, it has led to the creation and support of almost 11.3 million jobs in the U.S. that are supported by export-related activity. And as you know, these are good-paying jobs. These are jobs that pay anywhere from 15 to 18% above the national average. And one fact that so many Americans don't understand, because they tend to believe exporting is only for the big boys. It's for companies like Boeing or Caterpillar or some of the larger companies. But the reality is, of the 300,000 U.S. businesses that export, 98% of them are small businesses, as we define them here in our country. And businesses and exporters are not the only winners of a smart trade policy. Consumers, I believe, are actually the biggest winners. And we have to acknowledge, when we do that calculation, the trade isn't just a one-way street. It's not just about exporting. We also bring into this country the most innovative and creative products that are made from around the world. And that gives consumers and businesses more choice, because trade tends to foster innovation and competition, and it leads to more choices at lower prices for not only every American family, but for every business as well. And if you think about it, in reality, all a trade agreement is a tax cut for families. Because without those trade agreements in place, those tariffs are passed right down to the bottom line, and they're paid for by the families and businesses that buy those products. Finally, since 2009, trade liberalization has added an estimated 9% to our U.S. Economic base and almost $14 trillion in additional American income. Now that comes out to almost $13,000 average for every American family. Now, as good as these numbers are, as compelling as these statistics are, we still have to do more. And the reality is based on two things. One, the economic benefits of trade is not a secret. And we don't have the global marketplace to ourselves. Our competitors also understand that one of the fastest ways to stimulate growth in their economy is by selling more of what they make, what they create, what they grow to this increasing pool of new consumers around the world. And just one example, if you look in the Asia-Pacific region alone, over 200 free trade agreements have been put into effect over the last several years, all of which, if unresponded to, put you at a competitive disadvantage. And the most compelling figure, if you remember nothing else, and I know, I feel like I don't know why I'm giving you all speech, because you get this stuff. But I remind every audience that I talk to of the hard reality that 95% of the world's global, of the world's new consumers now live somewhere outside the United States. And when I was a mayor, that's what my police chief would say is a clue. We have to be engaged in the fight for the hearts and minds and wallets of these new consumers. And so that's why I think it's not only smart for the Renewable Fuels Association to be focused on global, going global, but it's also the right thing for our country. And it's one of the reasons in working with our president, we began to initiate what I believe is the most ambitious and compelling trade agenda for the United States in modern American history. I was privileged to work with the president on the launching of the two most ambitious multilateral trade agreements going on and being negotiated in the world right now. One of which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership with 11 of our partners in the Asia-Pacific and the APEC community. And the other is our Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership with the European Union. Both of these will dramatically expand economic opportunity for American families, for American farmers and ranchers, every one of our entrepreneurs and our businesses that export. It'll help boost U.S. economic growth, it'll support American jobs, and it helps to make products stamped made in America more dynamic and more affordable to these important regions. And these are particularly the TPP encompasses most of the most dynamic and fastest growing economies in the world. The cornerstone of this initiative is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that's not at all to diminish the impact of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And I want to take a little bit of time to talk about TPP in particular because we are hopefully in the final stages of negotiating that agreement to a successful conclusion. For those of you who don't know, this would be a state-of-the-art next-generation trade agreement that includes 11 countries, including the United States. It encompasses Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. And combined with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which would fully utilize trade throughout the United States and the European Union, which is already the most dynamic economic partnership in the world, just about $3 billion a day of commercial activity between the U.S. and the European Union. But if we were to fully liberalize trade between the U.S. and the EU, the estimates are that it could add almost $150 billion to our economy. And with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's estimated to give us access to over 40% of global GDP. You combine the two together, this would now give us access to 70% of global GDP at much less reduced tariffs and duties. And the Asia-Pacific is among the fastest-growing economic markets in the world. Currently, there are 525 million middle-class consumers in the region defined as the Asia-Pacific. This is projected to grow to 2.7 billion by 2030. The economic impact of the Trans-Pacific Partnership they put into place, and this is according to a study by the Peterson Institute, would increase U.S. exports by $123 billion a year and help to grow our economy by $77 billion a year. But just as importantly, the TPP is critical for us because it would be the first important trade agreement launched this century. And if you think about how differently the world is today than when NAFTA went into effect 20 years ago, when we did NAFTA, we didn't have a labor chapter. There was no environmental chapter. There was no such things as blog. We didn't think of economic commerce in the digital world and the digital transfer of data the way that we do now. This will allow us to have a trade agreement that reflects the reality of how we do business today. And it would help us to modernize and update NAFTA in a practical way since it includes Mexico and Canada, while at the same time having some of the strongest provisions as it relates to labor and protecting the rights of workers, protecting the environment, promoting access to innovation, combating anti-corruption, helping foster anti-corruption, and making it easier for small businesses to participate in this economic miracle. And just as critically, it would give you, as U.S. exporters, the level playing field that you need to compete in this important market. And passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership would also complement our overall efforts to rebalance and strengthen some of our historic strategic interest in the Southeast Asian region, particularly with crucial partners like Japan, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Australia, and so many others. So listening to all this, you have to say, well, then what's the problem? Why is this so hard? Why can't we get it passed? And the reality is once you get outside of conferences and rooms like this, is there are still too many Americans that have just gone sour on the value proposition of trade. And they just don't believe that America has benefited from trade. Now, I know it's changed a little bit because of the success that we've had, but I remember when I came into office, I was daunted by a poll that the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a liberal publication, had done, and they just polled Americans and asked them one question. On balance, do you believe trade has been good for America? And over 70% of Americans said no. Now, if that wasn't enough to sort of dull my enthusiasm for this new job, then I invited in some friends of mine on the Democratic side because I wanted my staff to understand the necessity of us attacking differently. And so they had done a bunch of polling, and they asked Americans a couple of questions. One, and we just went through a period where I do my the only time I buy a lottery ticket is when whatever you call it, the mega ball or whatever gets to over $400 or $500 million. But because I have an equation that I have to win enough money to satisfy all my deadbeat relatives, then they're going to call and ask me for money and still have enough left over. So anytime it gets over $400 or $500 million, I'm going to buy a ticket. But you know what the odds of that are. But they asked Americans, do you believe you'll win the lottery? Do you believe you'll win a Powerball lottery? And you know what the odds of that are. Three times more Americans answered yes, that they believed they'd win the lottery, than answered the question, I believe trade is good for America. And if that's not enough to sober you, then they asked them, and I can't make this stuff up. This was done by a group called the Third Way Group. They asked them, do you believe in the existence of extraterrestrial beings? You believe in UFOs? Twice as many Americans said they believed in the existence of UFOs than believed the trade was good for America. No, I'm not saying this to try to get you down, but I want you to understand the collective work, and I use we a lot, that we have to go out and tell the story of the real benefits of trade. Because even now, it's just counterintuitive to many of your neighbors and your friends and even some of your workers that one of the ways we're going to continue to grow our economy and create jobs here is by America being more aggressive than ever before in going out and executing trade agreements. So we have to work harder to sell Americans and explain to Americans the value proposition of why trade makes sense for us. But I'll go back to one thing I learned as mayor. The good news is that the truth is an option. And we do have a good story to tell. And those moments that I am most sort of beat up, I think, sometimes by my friends that think trade's bad and we oughtn't be doing any of this. I tend to go back and look at the words of people wiser than I. And I think one of the most underrated philosophers, American philosophers of this past century was Yogi Berra. And as only Yogi could say, I love telling my friends, the future ain't what it used to be. And the reality is that the way we're going to continue to sustain this economic miracle here in the United States is we've got to go out and fight and compete for these 95% of consumers who don't live in America. But I'm buoyed by the fact, from having been privileged to travel around the world and represent you and our country, that the words made in America are still the most treasured band in the world. There's not a family in the world that worries about putting food on their table if it's come in a container grown in America. There's not a business in the world that's not eager to buy a product or a service that has been made in this country, because there's an implied value proposition that if it's been made here, it's been made to a certain standard, and that it'll do what you said it'll do. And if it doesn't, we have a rule of law that says you have a way to figure it out. And that gives us a great leg up on our competitors. But we can't win if we're not in the game. And so we need your help to work to tell the stories. Don't take for granted that even your workers understand the benefits and why you're working so hard to increase your exports of fuels around the world. Make sure that your workers understand that part of their paycheck comes from the fact that you're selling fuel now in markets all over the world. And make sure that they understand that the more we sell to consumers around the world, the stronger we are here at home. And I also need your help with one thing more practical. I can do this now since I'm not in the administration. But even as we speak, Congress is debating giving the president trade promotion authority. It used to be called fast track authority. And it's authority that every president has had since Franklin Roosevelt. And even though the president and the Congress share joint responsibility for international trade, the reality is no country is going to negotiate with the U.S. Congress. That's why they created the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative 60 or 50 years ago, so that we would speak with one voice. But what Trade Promotion Authority does is it sort of pre-negotiates the boundaries of what we want to accomplish with Congress. And the trade-off is once we get those trade agreements, we can bring them to Congress and they go on an up and down vote. And there is a fierce debate right now about extending that authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Agreement. But we need your help and hope you would become engaged in telling your friends in Congress who represent you to do that so that we can move forward and put these important trade agreements in place. I thank you so much for this privilege to spend this few moments with you. I'm still optimistic. I feel better about our future than ever before, and I am more confident the trade's going to be a part of that, because America has never shirked from a challenge. And notwithstanding what you may hear from other folks, we still have the strongest economy in the world. We certainly have the most dynamic consumer economy in the world. We have the best colleges and universities and intellectual infrastructure of any of our competitors. And that means we have the most creative and innovative workforce, the most creative and innovative entrepreneurs that are represented by the important work that you do in your association. And that means that we can win if we have a chance to get in the game. But we can't win if we don't compete. And so, like you, I want America to continue to lead, and I want us to win by going global. So welcome to Dallas. I wish you great prosperity and good luck, and God bless you to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
I hope that's what you
The ambassador will take a question, too. I just want to say thank you. That was terrific. You blew me away with that one stat that 98% of the 300,000 companies that export from the United States are small businesses. That's pretty amazing.
You know, that surprised me when I came into office, and I'll be honest. I presumed exporters were all big companies. But the reality is most of our exporters are small businesses. But we also think that created a huge opportunity for us to reach this goal of doubling exports, because the global average among most countries is at about, you know, their percentage of exports. I'm sorry, we were at 95, others are at 98. If we could just move that up a little bit, that was an easy way for us to grow the economy. And you all know, and I would imagine your association sort of mirrors that numbers. Most of you are what we would define
small businesses. Yeah.
And as you know, most Americans work in a company that employs fewer than 20 people. So one of the things that the president charged us in particular was he wanted everybody to work together to make it easier for small businesses to get into exporting.
Yeah.
And so working with the SBA, the Commerce Department, we've tried to put more tools in the hand of businesses that export to make it easier for them. And I will tell you one other statistic, one of the most interesting we found. Of those 98% of small businesses who export, 75% of you only sell to one country and one customer. And the reason we know this, and I know we love to beat up on Washington about how we don't coordinate, we have an export panel, and on that export advisory panel that advises the president, we had both the president of UPS and FedEx. And they told us, they said, we can tell you who these people are because we're shipping those packages. And it's not smart for business or for them. So we started with those customers and put them with the Commerce Department and said, look, if you're already selling to Mexico, let's go find you 10 more customers. And all of that, I think, went into those numbers that you saw that were so successful in helping us to get the exports up.
I don't see anybody heading to the mic, so I'll ask one question. And I know you're aware of this issue because Ed would beat you up on it when you were ambassador. And I'm not going to ask you specifically how you would address it because I know you are too much of a professional to put Mr. Froman in an uncomfortable position. So Ambassador Froman is going to do what he does. But you know that we have had this trade issue with Europe, and we continue to fight that. But now as the United States is careening towards a new free trade agreement with the European Union, how would you counsel us to engage in a constructive way given that we were coming from a place of great difficulty given the current trade
barriers? We're talking about renewable fuel standards. But the good news is Ambassador Froman, I won't put him on the spot. Mike Froman's doing a great job. He's taking the same position that I did with Europe, that they've got to have standards that are in place that are fair and impartial. And they can't be put in place to give them a competitive advantage. I happen to think that was a bad rule. We fought it. We're going to continue to fight it. And one of the things we're working on, what differentiates the proposed trade agreement with Europe from the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that for the first time in a long time, you don't get the knee-jerk reaction against the European agreement because people don't see it as a third-world country. So there's no incentive to, you know, shift jobs from here and there. We have both strong labor laws and we have advanced rule of law. Our problems with Europe are on areas like this, where Europe, under the guise of culture, wants to put in standards and rules that we know have the net effect of putting you in a compromised position. So I would tell you I'm very comfortable that I think Ambassador Froman, who I co-chaired our Transatlantic Council with when he was the president's Sherpa, as we called him, will be as firm in demanding that we get this addressed as before. But Europe, and this is an area where Europe and the United States shouldn't be fighting one another. I mean, what makes your industry special is that consumers all over the world want to meet our energy needs, and they want to do it in a more environmentally responsible way. And if you look at the explosive opportunity for growth, again, in China, in Asia, in India, there's room enough for all of us. So we don't need these gimmicks to try to create some unfair advantage. And we just want Europe to do what you guys have done, which is innovate and come up with a product that works that consumers want to buy.
That sounds like a perfect place to end this conversation. Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us.
Appreciate it.